Hi, everyone. Welcome to Interpreter Insights. I'm Terry Hutchinson. My special guest tonight is Dan Peterson, the president and founder, one of the founders, I should say, of the Interpreter Foundation. Tonight, our discussion topic is going to be the Interpreter Foundation's 14th birthday, and Dan's here to talk about that, talk about what's upcoming for our 15th year, as well as answer some other questions that have been burning in my mind, especially since he's so prolific on social media. The mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. And we invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like the podcast, feel free to subscribe, tell your friends about it. In fact, tell your friends about Interpreter Foundation and what we do. Invite them to go to the website. There's all kinds of things there, not to mention links to movies, links to other things, and Dan and I will be talking about that later. Now, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. Now, unlike some other places, there is no place to donate for this podcast. Part of the reason is we're not paid. In fact, very few people in the Interpreter Foundation are paid, and that includes Dan. So, yeah. Your money goes to take care of all of our functions, and the Interpreter Foundation is a 501c3 corporation. So make sure that when you go to the website, find a place to donate. Any donation is going to be appreciated. We'll be grateful for it. And there's a special section on the website where you can see exactly where the money goes. So I encourage you to do that. But in the meantime, I want to welcome Dan to the program. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Before we begin talking about the Interpreter Foundation birthday, well, the thing that got me into the Interpreter in the first place was the journal articles that have been published every week. And I have been a subscriber since 2012.
Great.
Now, I have only been a participant for about, 9 years now. John Gee and I were talking about that on our last episode, but I've been following the journal avidly. And so on this podcast, I propose that we take one or two of the volumes of the past articles and just kind of do a brief survey and review of it. And so we're going to do volume 7 and volume 8. Volume 7 was the last volume published in 2013. There were four of them. And then 2014, the first volume is volume 8. Now, typically in each volume, Dan, you do an introduction.
Yeah.
So, this is weird because in volume 7, you did one, but you were republishing a talk by Elder Neil Maxwell. Tell us a little about that, if you would, just a couple of minutes.
Sure. He gave what I regard as a very important talk. It turned out to be one of his very last talks. He came down to BYU. Of course, we knew that he'd been ill. We thought he was doing better, but he passed away shortly after that. And he gave a really positive talk about the function of apologetics and so on. Now, we didn't know, there was no text of it that survived, but Matt Roper got a recording of it and transcribed it. Then I got approval from Elder Maxwell's family to run that because we thought it was such a valuable document. And it was his final thoughts on the idea of apologetics. He had always been sort of a patron of ours, very, very friendly, very interested in what we were doing. And one of the last things he said was, it would be a real pity if you were to lose your focus. He said, some organizations do that. And, you know, I was thinking at the time, there were some books on charitable foundations that had been established by people with a certain political or social cultural view, like the Ford Foundation, which within a few years are taken over by people whose views are almost the opposite of the founders, what the founders wanted the money to be used for and to support. And so he said, it would be a real pity if you were to lose your direction and go a different way. Well, that is in fact what happened not too terribly long after that, because there was a kind of coup and a different group of people took over the leading of the foundation. So I thought it was an important thing to get that on record, that Elder Maxwell liked the way we had been going and didn't want us to change it, but did change.
Well, an interpreter was the appropriate place to put it because this is really the successor to the original Farms and the original Maxwell Institute.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we had the same mindset and the new group at Maxwell, even if they, I think now they're under leadership that is okay, but they're not doing what what we founded the organization to do anymore, and likely never will.
No, they don't have the personnel.
Right.
And I don't know if they have the interest, but that's a topic for another time.
Yeah.
So this volume seven, let me just read some of the headlines or the titles of these pieces in the articles. And if something comes out to you, Dan, just let's make a note. An essay on the one true morality and the principle of freedom by Alma Dawn Sorensen. Now,
that was a little difficult to get. Dawn Sorensen was one of my teachers of political philosophy at BYU when I was an undergraduate. And it's kind of a deep essay, not the easiest reading, but he's arguing about what the basic moral principles of the gospel are that run from the premortal existence on up to, the life to come. I thought it was really interesting to have a take on that by a really good political philosopher. So,
well, and people think that the Interpreter just publishes lightweight stuff. This is a pretty heavy-duty article, but it is 47 pages,
right?
Which fascinates me sometimes, the length. There were 17 replies, and a lot of times, readers, I'd encourage you, because all of these are available on the website for free.
Right.
You just go to the journal. You can find them. Go to the replies, because there's often a back and forth between the authors and the readers. And some of the readers are very negative occasionally, and that's all well and good as long as they meet certain civil discourse rules. Okay, the next one is, I do not think that word means what you think it means, from Brant Gardner. And if I remember right, he's talking about Richard O'Brien's book about misreading scripture with Western eyes.
Yeah.
So there's a cultural thing there. Then it was followed by the original text of the Book of Mormon and its publication by Yale University Press.
Yeah.
By Royal Skousen himself.
Yeah,
I have
and
to tell you.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Interpreter's been involved in, heck, when I was with Forums before that in the Maxwell Institute, we were deeply involved with Royal Skousen's work and have tried to be supportive of it. And not everybody has been supportive of it. So we try to step forward and make sure that things
I
work.
Have the volumes, and I, as you know, I did a daily book review for more than 30 years on the radio. And so I even interviewed Royal on a radio program. Confession time, Dan, that was a rough one.
Oh, I can imagine.
For consumer radio, we'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
But the books are brilliant, and I love books about books. I love articles about books.
Yeah.
A great book that you may interest you if Winston Churchill is somebody you're fond of is called In Command of History.
Oh.
And it's about how he wrote his memoirs on World War II and then how they compared with the real history.
Okay.
Just a fascinating book by David Reynolds. So the next is Where Shall Wisdom Be Found by Zena Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
Then Sophic Box and Mantic Vista, a review of Deconstructing Mormonism by Kevin Christensen. And then he added another book in there about paradigms, because that's Kevin's real big thing is paradigms.
Right, right.
And that was
a book by Thomas Riskus. I don't know that it's had much impact. I know one ex-Latter-day Saint who thinks it's just a devastating expose on the church. I don't know of anybody else who was convinced by it or particularly impressed by it. It hasn't made much of a splash, but it got a really solid review there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So Kevin did a great job, as he always does. And then there's a two-parter, which is, if I get my math right, 150 pages, 140 pages between the two articles by Greg Smith about passing up the heavenly gift.
Yeah.
And those are reviews of a new movement founded by a man who left the church named Denver Snuffer. Snuffer?
Right.
Snuffer.
Snuffer, yeah. Snuffer. You know, when I first heard that name, apparently a lot of other people had heard of him before I had. When I heard the name the first time, I thought, no, that can't really be his name, Denver Snuffer, but it really is his name.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and he's an attorney. And so I knew about the name before I ever heard about this movement, because I would see his name occasionally on, you know, certain legal cases or whatever. I don't remember ever trying a case against him, although for 40 years it's possible. But.
Yeah.
You know,
no, that was an important one. And the thing about Greg Smith, he's an amazing guy. He's an emergency room physician up in Alberta.
Yeah.
And a pianist. And at that time, I think he was a bishop. And he would say, well, I'm going to try to do a little look at such and such, and it won't be very long. And then it would come in at, 150 pages with 850 footnotes, and I think, how in the world does he do this?
Yeah,
he can't not sleep.
I don't think he sleeps, exactly. And I'll tell you that to a certain degree, I think we'd have to say that Greg Smith is one of the reasons why the Interpreter Foundation exists.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he was with us with the Old Farms Review, and when I got the boot, he got the boot too. And so several of us decided we're not going to drop the torch. We're going to pick it up and keep it going. And so he was one of the people I tried to invite from the very beginning.
Well, and on the website, we still have available the paper that caused all the things, problems, that was never published, except for it's available on the website. Those are drafts.
Right. And, and that was
took
his
me a minute to find them, but I did.
Yeah. That was his response to John DeLynn, and it was meticulously documented.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I thought a really valuable contribution because, you know, even his ecclesiastical leaders, John DeLynn's, were not aware of all that he was up to because he wasn't publishing it so much as doing it in online venues and so on.
Yeah.
When you put it all together, he's denying the deity, not only the deity, but the existence of Christ, attacking the doctrine of the atonement. Denying the existence of God, then he'd still call himself a Latter-day Saint. And we thought, well, how?
Well, for me, the most devastating part of Greg's papers was how he meticulously treated what DeLynn would say to one audience and then to another.
Yes.
You know, I ran across this with Will Bagley and my book show down in St. George. So he did this book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, I want to say 2005, something like that, maybe
Blood
earlier.
Of the Prophets.
Blood of the Prophets. Yeah. And, you know, I had him down. We had a friendly conversation on the air for about 45 minutes. And then I heard him on KUER up in Salt Lake. I happened to be up here driving to a court, and I heard the interview. And he was 180 degrees different than what he told me in St. George. Very anti-Brigham. And so then he came down again and I had him on a different program. That was not as pleasant for him. We'll just say that, because when you do that, the authors don't appreciate it. Now, I don't mind. I had Dan Vogel on and people were really frustrated with me. But it's like, you know, I got him to admit he's not an active LDS member because he was selling his Joseph Smith biography as someone who comes from the Mormon tradition.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to be intellectually honest. And if you are, you're fine. But anyway, Greg's work is terrific, and it'll pop up later in other places in Interpreter. And it's always very extensive, very well researched. And as often as he contributes, I'm on to it, Dan.
Yeah. I'll just tell you. He's an extraordinarily bright guy and meticulous in his research. It's amazing. He does.
Yeah. So the final one was an article that came a little bit too late for a friend of mine. It's called The Late War Against the Book of Mormon, and it's by Benjamin McGuire. And by that time, my friend he was doing okay back and forth, but he'd been struggling for a long time, and eventually he was just overwhelmed by, you know, he couldn't give up the podcasts he was always listening to. And the lunch group with these guys that he was with, and no matter how hard we tried, we just couldn't shake some of these things, and he stepped away from the church. So then we come to volume 8, which is the first one from 2014. And this, I'm not sure if it's the first one, but it's one of the few introductions that you never did. And it's written by Lou Midgley.
Right. Yeah, he had been an associate editor of the Old Farms Review. So I wanted to get Lou writing for us too, and have him, you know, have a crack at an introduction. Lou was at our birthday party, by the way, Saturday night. He's 96, still
kicking,
looking, but still very sharp.
Yeah, he was sitting by John Gee, and I don't know who was on the other side. You might have noticed, but they were very solicitous of him and very careful as he, you know, kind of walked his way slowly back to the refreshments where
he's
everybody
one of the grand
sat
old
at a round table.
I'm really fond of Lou. One of the strongest personalities I've ever encountered, and very distinctive. In fact, last night somebody said to him, "Well, Lou, we're glad to have you here." He said, "Between the speakers, we want you to do the haka, you know, the Maori dance. And
Yeah.
he began doing it right there.
Right there.
Calm down. No,
Yeah.
no.
So there are several very short articles in this one, but there's a couple of them that I thought were pretty important. One of them was the Cowdery Conundrum, Oliver's aborted attempt to describe Joseph Smith's first vision in 1834 and 1835 by Roger Nicholson. You know, that one was about 17 pages, but there was a long one in here. I want to say, well, also there's a very short one called Enoch and Noah on Steroids. And that's a review by Brian Buchanan, and I think it was published in the Association of Mormon Letters. And we got permission to reprint it here, which I think was appropriate because it was the first book published by the Interpreter Foundation in conjunction with Eborn Books. So I had Jeff on my radio program to talk about that book. I've reviewed it in Meridian. I've been a big follower of Jeff's works and have reviewed them several times. Personally, I like mine better, but this guy did okay.
We're I've been really pleased over the years to get the kinds of people that we've gotten, really interesting ideas, and so that was a nice one.
Yeah. So then we have Hagar in LDS Scripture and Thought. And that's about a 50-page article about how we've treated Hagar as Latter-day Saints over the years. And I would imagine that has a special place for you, considering your emphasis on the other
Islam.
children of Abraham, so to
Right,
speak.
right. Because Hagar is revered among them, as the mother of Ishmael and so on. So, they're very conscious of that and were from the beginning. That was really nice to have. And I want to say something about articles like that. A lot of people think that we're always doing apologetics. We're always trying to do, some sort of mental gymnastics to defend the gospel against attack or prove it true or something. But a lot of it is just commentary on scripture, just elucidating, interpreting, if you will. Not all of it is out to prove some truth claim of the restoration. Some of it is just trying to shed some light on passages that might amaze and interest readers.
Just a couple of the others that were notable to me, and maybe that to you too. One of them was, "If there be faults, they be the faults of man," by Robert Smith. And then another one was A Brief History of Critical Text Work on the Book of Mormon by Royal Skousen. And so there we go with that critical textbook problem. And then, you know, Stephen Smoot, I mean, you read the names of the people on here. Some of them are, they contribute often, and some of them are very sporadic or rare. But even so, it's just a great place to get published. So if you're out there, listeners, I'd encourage you to submit something. Doesn't hurt.
No, and people ask me, well, do you have to have a PhD, to do it? And I said, no. All we care is that it be, A, we hope that it comes from a faithful perspective. We've made a few exceptions when we print a critic or something like that, but usually that's a requirement. But we define that pretty loosely. You don't have to agree with us in every detail. It just has to be well done. It has to meet the standards of evidence and logic. And so if a person has a PhD, look, I know many PhDs who can't argue their way out of a paper bag. I mean, they just their reasoning is not that good and their use of evidence isn't that good. And a lot of other people who don't have that kind of a degree who do really solid work. So we couldn't care less what the background of the author is, as long as the work itself is worth looking at. So
And
that's really important.
you publish original pieces too. The one that stands out in my mind all the time, and Martin Tanner and I have talked about this on the air, the one about the comet. And I said, I was asking, I think it was Alan Wyatt, or I can't remember who it was. It might have been Jeff Lindsay. How did you find readers for that?
I know. Sometimes it's difficult because you think, well, who has the expertise to deal with this one? It's important to stress that we do peer review for this, and we reject a fair number of articles, including I have a story to tell about a former neighbor of mine whom I home taught. He wrote something that I really liked, and I encouraged him to submit it to interpreter. And he did, and I went down one night to do my home teaching. He opened the door and he was clearly upset with me. And I didn't know what was going on. I said, "Why did you reject my paper?" I said, "Did we?" And he said, "Yes, I just got the notice about 20 minutes ago." And he was very unhappy. He told me he was a full professor in a mathematical related field. He said, "I have never had a paper rejected by a journal before, ever. This is the first in my career." And I actually think the reviewers maybe made a mistake. I still liked the piece, but the fact is we reject things, and there is a rigorous peer review process that these things go through, and I don't control it. I don't want to control it. I want it to be independent.
Well, and that is the follow-up, because that's going to lead us into our celebration. You know, we're recording this on the 9th of August, but our celebration of the 14th birthday of the interpreter. I love those. My wife loves those. We enjoy going to them and seeing all the people who put these things together that we look at all year and just marvel at the scholarship and the faithfulness of the people that are doing it. And always looking forward to some clip from Jeff Bradshaw in a film. Or from you with Becoming Brigham, like we did last year.
No, it's amazing to me because we don't pay any of these guys, and we don't pay the people who submit articles to us. And yet, we have never missed a week of publication.
How many
I
weeks is
have
it
that as
now?
a goal. I actually calculated. I think it's 733 consecutive weeks. And Interpreter had only been founded about 734 and a half weeks, ago. So within a week and a half, we had our first article going up. And I thought, well, we'll do a few and make a splash, and then we'll see what we can do after that. They just kept coming. And it's not like we pay the authors anything. They don't get a nickel. But now, since August of 2012, we've never missed a Friday. Sometimes we've published two or even three. Right now, we've had a little bit of a problem because our queue's getting too long. So we're having to put out a couple of articles, or maybe even three at some point. Otherwise, the queue will get so long that I like to be able to tell people, if you write for us, unlike some journals that I've published in, you write the article, they accept it, and then it comes out 3 or 4 years later and you can't even remember it. Do I still agree with that? I don't know. I tell them, no, it'll be published within a reasonable amount of time, which means that we have to keep that queue going, keep the stuff coming out.
But it does take a while to get through the queue, as everybody has pointed out to me. In fact, people would be surprised at those who have been rejected. They would just think, oh, yeah, that guy, everything he does, if he wants, he just goes to Interpreter and it's published.
It's
No,
not
it's
automatic.
not.
No,
No.
no.
Not.
No, and it goes through pretty meticulous source checking and copy editing to get the grammar and everything right, eliminate all the mistakes. And not that we're flawless, so I still see things that come out and just bang my head and think, how did that get through the process? But I've seen that in really, really mainstream journals too, where embarrassing things are published. But it's a pretty rigorous process. And I've had some people tell me who were published that that's one of the toughest review processes I've ever had to go through. Our review committee doesn't just vote up or down on a submission. Quite often they'll say up, but you need to do this, you need to do that. We expect more of this, a little more evidence on that point, and go back and strengthen it. It results in better papers, I hope. But it's not an easy process, and we have some very dedicated editors working on this, and I'm grateful for that. So the idea that we're kind of a rag that just publishes anything that's turned into us just immediately goes up online, this is simply not true.
No, well, and that brings us to the 14th year. How many volunteers do we have?
Oh gosh. It's hard for me to know. I met some last night that I'd never heard of before. So, one young woman came up to me and said, "Well, I'm working as an editor for you." And I said, "Oh, you are? Great.
Good.
Glad to hear it." But I don't know. We have, I don't know how many hundred authors that we've had. I mean, those are volunteers on one level. And then at any given moment, we'll have half a dozen serious editors. And then who knows how many copy editors? It goes up and down, and people who do source checking. Because I remember something that Allison Coutts told me once. She was for a long time, the director of publications for the Old
Yeah,
National Institute.
I loved her.
Oh, she's a wonderful person. But she said, you know, if we get a comma wrong in a quotation, anybody else could do that. And they just say, oh, you know, a mistake got past the editors. No, if we get a comma wrong or omit a word from a quotation, that's deliberate apologetic deceit. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Said, our standard has to be higher than it has to be for a lot of publishers. If Oxford gets a comma wrong, big deal. It's Oxford. But if it's us, well, we're liars trying to deceive the populace out there, you know?
Yeah.
So we check everything, make sure that the quote in context says what the author says it does. We look it up, and so we try to get it right. Even so, we're human, and we, you know, errors get by, but it's a pretty high standard.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the last year then, one of the major projects, in addition to the journal and the weekly articles that have come out, what are some of the other things the journal that the Interpreter has been up to?
Well, we've done conferences. We had a big conference just recently on the BYU campus here in Provo on the small plates of Nephi. There was a generous donor out there who said, and he was kind of right, he said, you know, you guys have done some really good conferences on the temple, even on science and religion and so on, but you don't have that many conferences on the Book of Mormon. For an organization that really is centered on the Book of Mormon, that's kind of odd, don't you think? And I thought, yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of odd. So he said, I want to put up the money to do one on the small plates of Nephi. So we got Matt Bowen and Karamea Wright at BYU Hawaii to spearhead this one. And it was wonderful. And it was especially wonderful because they got a lot of people from Hawaii to participate. Mm-hmm. Which we've never done before. I've wanted to get beyond the usual BYU and, you know, sort of Provo, Orem, Salt Lake axis, get some people out there. And so we got a lot, including students who came over and helped out. And it was a great experience. And for them, I think. So we were really pleased with that. We got some very good material. And that's going to eventually result in, there were so many papers given, in I think a 2-volume collection of papers. We always try to A, put the talks up online so that people can watch them, either stream them live or watch them later. But we also like to publish them. I don't like when I'm writing something to cite a video. I want to cite it in print with a page number.
Well, and it helps to have the footnotes and the citations that they're relying on. That's why I rarely watch the videos. I confess, I'm a footnote guy.
Right. You know, and some people aren't. And they'd rather watch it on a video.
Oh, for sure. So, I think that's the majority of people these days.
Yeah. So part of what I've said about what Interpreter does, I mean, when we publish an article, we have a whole lot of venues, of which I use almost none, you know, where you can go and have the article read to you. You can see it on this little platform or that platform. I don't use those. I read it. Mm-hmm. Just conventional. I'm of the Gutenberg generation, I guess, probably a dying breed, But that's what I want to do. But I've said before, we want to be where the people are, where the audience is. So whatever their favorite mode is of consuming, I don't necessarily like that verb, but consuming what we produce, well, we'll try to be there. If you'd rather watch it on video, then we'll create a video. If you'd rather listen to it in an audiobook form, we'll do that. We have people read the articles so that you can just listen to it while you're jogging. And I don't do that. But a lot of people do, including at least one member of our board that I know listens to all the articles while he's commuting to work. So,
I mean, there's some articles that I wouldn't listen to just because they don't particularly interest me, but there's a lot of them that are there. And then kind of like the comment one we talked about earlier, there's some that just strike me like lightning. It's like, really? I never even thought of this before. Right. This is fantastic.
Right. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
In addition to that, you spent a lot of this past year and the first half of this year producing Becoming Brigham.
Yeah. That is something that I'm deeply involved in. I do filming on that about 1 week out of every month. And so I've been to Nauvoo more times in the past year than I'd ever been before. You know, altogether, I think. And so we film some on location. We interview scholars, usually in Salt Lake at the Church History Library or so on. But we try to set the stage. We're talking about a story that happened at Winter Quarters. We'll be at Winter Quarters for at least a few minutes of the broadcast. Give people a feel for it. Give them the sense of authenticity. We were down at Mountain Meadows about a month ago, maybe a little longer.
I was going to say it would be pretty hot now, so I hope it was a little while earlier.
Well, and there was a big fire nearby, so it wasn't altogether pleasant.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
But still, we managed to avoid the worst of that. But you know, to film out there and give people a sense of the reality of the story. It's not our, not my favorite story out of church history, not the most inspiring. But actually, part of what we're trying to do is address all of the difficult issues that people raise with Brigham Young. And I still see claims. I saw them yesterday. Brigham Young ordered the Mountain Meadows Massacre. He hated all non-Mormons traveling through Utah territory. He tried to have them killed. He was responsible for every murder west of the Mississippi, practically, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just absolute nonsense. So, but we want to address those things head on. So we've recorded an interview, for example, with Rick Turley, who is, you know, the premier authority on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And it's not easy listening. Latter-day Saints don't always come out looking very well.
Mm-hmm.
But Brigham Young, on the whole, does. We will say, you know, Brigham, his rhetoric was a little tough. Maybe that contributed, but I don't think very significantly. But he certainly did not order the massacre. He opposed it. I've said before, you know, you can say, let's assume that Brigham Young really is evil. Nobody's ever accused him of being stupid. And the Mountain Meadows Massacre was stupid.
Yeah.
It was ill-timed, yeah. Right at the time of the Utah War. He would never have done that, even if he were evil. He was too cagey to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, he didn't order it. Remember, he sent the messenger down to stop it or to make sure that they were unharmed.
Yeah.
And I remember that's how Rick Turley's first volume on the massacre ended, was that guy sitting down in the street and crying.
Yeah.
Too late. It's too late.
Too late. It had just happened.
Oh, gosh.
Missed it by hours, really.
Yeah. Just heart-wrenching.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and then Brigham, it's pretty clear, for a while, wasn't sure exactly what had happened. He was being given false information. People were feeding him lies out of southern Utah, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, it was the Indians that did it and so on. He believed that for a while, but then it didn't add up. So he began sending members of the 12 down to interview people and began to realize, no, this I've been fed lies. There were Latter-day Saints involved in this.
Well, I thought that Rick and Barbara did a great job in their book about that. And then Janice followed it up with hers. And if I remember right, though, hers was more on the media reception.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things you learned from that book and from the second volume of Rick Turley's with Barbara is that they were so eager to get Brigham Young that John D. Lee sat there through his first trial, almost ignored, like, who cares about him? We want to get the big fish. Well, the thing is, the big fish wasn't guilty. They couldn't come up with anything.
They couldn't
so
find it.
Finally, a new lawyer came in and tried John D. Lee, actually tried John D. Lee, and he was convicted because he was guilty. But Brigham Young was not.
And they said that the other guys, nobody else was ever brought to justice, as if that was Brigham's fault. But a lot of them escaped. And, you know, they hid in Mexico and all kinds of other places. Yeah.
It was incompetent prosecution in a lot of cases.
Oh,
Well, at first were available. They could have gotten them, but they were not interested. They wanted Brigham.
They did. Yeah. And that becomes obvious when you study the history of that event.
Yeah. So ultimately, Isaac Haight was excommunicated and John D. Lee was executed, and some of that happened. But, you know, it's a sad story. It's a blot on the history of the church. But it is not a blot on the history of Brigham Young, and that's one of the points we're trying to make.
Thank you for being with us for part one of our interview. Join us next episode for part two.